Geoscience. Physics. Mathematics. Biotechnology. Medicine.
Astronomy. Evolution.
Planetary science. Ecology.
Cosmology. Genetics.
Information technology.
Botany.
SciPod.
SciPod.
This is SciPod.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on SciPod, current crisis. The Gulf Stream is weakening dramatically. Is Europe headed for a mini ice age? Invisible touch. Astronomers reveal how dark energy guides the fate of the universe. And wiping away bad memories. The drug that promises relief from post-traumatic stress. We'll have all these stories as well as our weekly quiz. You could win a Bose Sound Dock. And all you have to do is play. That's coming up. But first, here's Donna Page.
Thanks, Bill. The ocean current that gives Western Europe its mild climate appears to be weakening. That startling result comes from a British study published in the journal Nature. Scientists measured the amount of warm water flowing into the North Atlantic via the Gulf Stream, and to their surprise, found a 30% reduction compared to similar studies done over a decade ago. This week, New Scientist climate reporter Fred Pierce delves into the finding and its implications.
What's been done is that the researchers did a transect across the Atlantic from Africa to Florida and assessed the heat flows going north and south. And they found that while the Gulf Stream itself was continuing pretty much as in previous surveys, that more of the Gulf Stream's water was flowing immediately back to the south in the what they call the subtropical gyre of the tropics, and much less was going north into the far north Atlantic, where it's responsible for helping to keep Europe much warmer than it would otherwise be without the warm current.
The study also confirmed that less cold water was moving in the opposite direction, in the deep water current that starts off the coast of Greenland and plunges southward along the ocean floor. The cause of the change is unclear, but global warming is a likely suspect, and it could be affecting ocean circulation in a variety of ways.
What's being suggested is really two things both happening in the far North Atlantic. First of all, less ice forming and more melting going on. And secondly, greater river flows, particularly in the rivers flowing into the Arctic from Siberia. Now, both those effects will tend to make the North Atlantic fresher. And if the water's fresher, the processes that drive the ocean water to the bottom of the ocean and drive the whole circulation will be reduced. Essentially, the water up there won't get salty enough, won't get dense enough to fall to the bottom of the ocean. And if that happens, then the pull for the Gulf Stream water to be brought back to the north is reduced. So the whole system will begin to shut down.
But whatever is causing the change, there seems to be little doubt that it's real. In fact, researchers found that a U.S. study done in the late 1990s shows a similar trend, although it was not recognized at the time. But perhaps the most surprising aspect of this discovery is that the climate of Western Europe has not cooled down, despite the fact that the Gulf Stream is delivering much less warm water to the North Atlantic.
It's a bit of a mystery. Why haven't we seen the cooling? And one suggestion is that the global warming processes that were seen very strongly in the 1990s may have simply swamped the cooling effect. Some of the oceanographers I've spoken to say, well, the warming that we saw in the oceans in the 1990s has kind of tailed off in the last 5, 6, 7 years. Maybe what we're seeing is these two competing processes, the cooling caused by the change in the circulation, the warming caused by the warming of the atmosphere, kind of cancelling each other out, and that's why we haven't seen a bigger cooling effect. But of course, so far, if the study is right, we've seen roughly a 20% drop in the amount of heat coming north towards Europe. And I guess the worry is that if the whole system becomes unstable and we see maybe a 30% or a 40% or a 50% cut in the heat coming north, at that point, I think most people believe that Europe would notice and might start heading off in the direction of something like the little ice age that we saw here a few hundred years ago.
While it may seem odd that a part of the world known for its mild climate could start to get colder as a result of global warming, scientists caution that it's the kind of change we may have to start getting used to as the Earth's atmosphere becomes more energetic and volatile.
We're going to have to look forward to a period in which Some places get wet, some places get dry, most places warm, but some places cool. That's going to be the kind of nature. That's, I think, why scientists have stopped talking so much about global warming, and they talk about climate change, because they do think it's going to be the variability and often the uncertainty that is going to be the scary thing. And in a sense, if we were just going to have warming, we could all cope with it and we'd know where we were going and perhaps plan for it. I think perhaps climate change, with all the uncertainty that goes with it, is going to be a much more difficult thing to cope with.
The good news is that this week's result comes from a joint US-UK effort to provide much closer monitoring of the Gulf Stream. So if Europe is headed for the deep freeze, at least it won't come as a total surprise.
And now, a phenomenon that caught physicists by surprise. Here's Jeffrey Whittle with this dark story.
It's the biggest question in physics. What's the invisible and mysterious phenomenon that's causing the expansion of the universe to speed up over time? It's known as dark energy, and its effects can be seen as a gradual acceleration in the rate at which galaxies in the universe are moving apart. Those effects were first reported in the late 1990s. Since then, scientists haven't come much closer to knowing what dark energy is, but this week, at least they seem to know a little more about what it isn't. Astronomers participating in the Supernova Legacy Survey have been watching exploding stars and distant galaxies to find out if the rate at which the universe is expanding is changing over time. Dr. Ray Carlberg of the University of Toronto is a member of the team.
The big physics issue is what is the nature of dark energy? We know that it dominates the expansion energy of the universe, but there's a number of physically different possibilities, and they're broadly, it could get weaker with time, get stronger with time, or stay the same. And Einstein's idea was the simplest one, which was that it stays the same with time.
Although Einstein was gone long before dark energy was discovered, his general theory of relativity allows for the inclusion of a mathematical term called the cosmological constant. Einstein introduced the term in 1921 as a way of explaining why gravity doesn't cause the universe to collapse in on itself. A few years later, astronomers discovered that the universe is expanding, which removed the need for a cosmological constant. Einstein was said to have called the constant his biggest blunder. But all of that changed when dark energy came along. Its presence means that the universe is not only expanding, its expansion is actually speeding up. One possible explanation is that Einstein's cosmological constant is driving the galaxies apart like a repulsive force. If this is true, then the expansion of the universe should be accelerating at a fixed rate, something that can only be measured by looking at the light coming from distant supernovas that exploded billions of years ago.
In the first year of the survey, we didn't really anticipate publishing anything, as we had only 71 supernovae. However, once we did the analysis, we were surprised and gratified that things were working as well as we expected, so that the outcome was that we've significantly improved the understanding of how the dark energy works, and our result is that to within 10%, dark energy behaves as Einstein predicted it was, that it's constant with time.
In addition to vindicating Einstein, the survey seems to eliminate a rather frightening possibility known as the Big Rip. In that scenario, the acceleration of the universe is itself speeding up until space is expanding so fast that all galaxies, stars, and even atoms are eventually torn apart. If the dark energy is described by a cosmological constant, then the Big Rip won't happen, although the universe will become a much lonelier place in the future.
The universe is going to, unless it falls out of this weird accelerating state, the galaxies that aren't gravitationally bound to us now are going to accelerate away, so that in roughly 10 times the age of the universe, we'll probably be the only galaxy we can see, bizarrely.
Carlberg and his colleagues eventually hope to use up to 700 supernovae to refine their measurements of the dark energy and to see if Einstein's constant continues to hold up. Of course, that's still just the beginning of a much larger quest by scientists to understand what the dark energy really is and what it says about the origin and fate of the universe.
Sometimes physics problems, once they're discovered, they can be solved in 10 years. There's other problems that take hundreds of years to solve. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
The first results from the Supernova Legacy Survey are reported in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. It's easy. Just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. That's podcast@newscientist.com.
And coming up next, a chance to win the grand prize in our weekly contest. But first, it's time for this week's cover story. From the Boston Bureau of New Scientist, here's Ivan Semenik.
Can bad memories be wiped away, and should they? These are questions facing researchers who are trying to combat post-traumatic stress disorder. People who suffer from it are often incapacitated by painful recollections of past events, and because the source of the problem is the patient's own memory, it's notoriously difficult to provide relief. Now, an experimental new approach promises to change the way doctors deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, one that involves intervening with the painful memories while they are still fresh. This week's New Scientist includes a feature story about the new approach and the researchers who are working at the frontiers of painful memory. One of those researchers is Dr. Roger Pittman. He's a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Hi, Dr. Pittman. Welcome to SciPod.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Maybe we should start by looking at how memories actually work. When someone experiences a traumatic event, how is that memory different from the way everyday memories are stored in the brain?
There's some very fundamental research done by someone by the name of Jim McGaw at the University of California in Irvine over the past 40 years that has made a very important discovery about brain and memory. There's a common phenomenon, which is that people tend to remember those things that are more emotionally arousing or emotionally significant. For example, I bet you that you can remember in fair detail where you were and what you were doing on September 11th, 2001 at 9 in the morning when you first learned of the World Trade Center disaster.
Sure.
I bet that you don't have nearly as clear a memory of where you were and what you were doing on September 10th, 2001 at the same time in the morning.
No, that's absolutely right.
Right. So this is the ability of what Jim McGaw calls significance to facilitate remembrance. And what Dr. McGaw has discovered over these past four decades is that the stress hormones that are released by emotionally arousing events will act in the brain to strengthen the consolidation of the memory of that event. Now, you can have a pretty good memory in detail of where you were at the time of the World Trade Center disaster. Imagine, however, instead of, I don't know how you learned about it, my guess is you probably saw it in television or someone told you about it.
Right, heard it on the radio
heard
on the way
it
to
radio.
Work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, supposing instead of hearing it on the radio, you had been in the building running for your life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine how much more stress hormones would have been activated in that circumstance? And how much more deeply the memory could have been consolidated? Well, that's what I think is going on in post-traumatic stress disorder. I think post-traumatic stress disorder is an excess or an overshoot of a normally adaptive mechanism whereby significance facilitates remembrance.
Could you describe the treatment you're working on and how it might relieve the overpowering sense of a traumatic memory?
Well, for the past 3 or 4 years, we've been working on trying to reduce the amount of consolidation that occurs in the aftermath of a traumatic event under the influence of these high release of stress hormones. There's a drug called propranolol, which is an anti-adrenaline drug, which has the ability to block the ability of stress hormones to potentiate memory. It doesn't block the formation of memory at all. It doesn't create amnesia. What it does is reduce the excessively intense memories that are formed under the influence of the stress hormones. So what we did in our first study, and that we're now doing in a larger follow-up study, is to wait for people to come into the emergency room at the Massachusetts General Hospital after they've had a severe psychologically traumatic event, such as a bad accident or an assault. And we asked them if they're willing to participate in research in which they're given propranolol very shortly after the event in an attempt to reduce the excessive memory consolidation of that event and hopefully to prevent the development of these long-standing, intense, painful, traumatic memories and living and reliving experience.
And how did the results compare when patients are willing to take part in the study and they receive the treatment, what happens?
In our first result, which was a preliminary pilot study, we found that the people who received the propranolol right after the traumatic event, and the average time we got to them was within 4 hours on the average, the people that got the propranolol had weaker memories of the traumatic event when we measured them in our laboratory than the people who had received a drug that looked like the propranolol but didn't have anything in it, the placebo.
Mm.
We feel that if we had gotten to them within an hour of their traumatic event instead of 4 hours, we would have had a bigger effect. But we have produced preliminary data suggesting that we can reduce the overconsolidation of traumatic memories if we get to people within the window of opportunity.
And how does this compare now with existing treatments for post-traumatic stress?
Well, the difference here is that we are trying to do a prevention rather than a treatment here. We're really trying to get to people before they develop PTSD and prevent them from getting it. Once people have PTSD, then you're looking at a different question. The problem then is that the window of opportunity to modulate consolidation is long ago closed. You know, in some instances, in Vietnam veterans, for example, 30 years ago. And now you're trying to give them antidepressant drugs to reduce their symptoms and a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavior therapy to help them learn not to be afraid of the things that they tend to be afraid of, to help them contain their symptoms. However, there now is a new possibility on the horizon, and that is recent research in animals, which has been performed by a friend of mine named Kareem Nader and other people, which suggests that actually that window of opportunity to modulate memory consolidation can be reopened even long after the memory has been consolidated by reactivating the memory. So the possibility exists that if you can reactivate the memory and then give people propranolol, you can then block the reconsolidation of the memory in a similar way to the way you blocked the original consolidation and possibly reduce PTSD symptoms in people who already have PTSD.
I'm wondering if you think there's a downside. As you were saying, this is probably some kind of an evolved response to a significant event. Is there any problem or any reason to worry about, you know, alleviating these stressful memories?
Let me say that I think there are theoretical reasons to worry, but that we didn't really find anything to worry about in our first preliminary study.
What do you think are the theoretical reasons?
Well, the theoretical reasons might be that that it's important for people to be able to remember certain things better, and it's important for society to benefit from the ability of people to remember traumatic things. And I respect that argument, although I don't think that there's really a conflict with trying to use the drug to prevent a mental disorder that will make people quite dysfunctional. In other words, the ideal would be some degree of memory which enables the person to learn and benefit from the experience, but not such an intense degree of memory that they become paralyzed by their re-experiencing phenomena.
Well, this all sounds like very exciting work for a very tough disorder. Thanks, Dr. Pittman, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Roger Pittman spoke to us from Boston.
Now it's time for Insight, our weekly quiz. The rules are simple. Each week we ask you one insightful question. All you have to do is provide the one-word answer, which you can usually find somewhere in the pages of New Scientist magazine or newscientist.com. Last, we ask you, according to the standard definition of obesity, which means a body mass index of 30 or greater, about how many obese people are there in the world today? And the one-word, or in this case, the one-number answer, is 1 billion. Everyone who answered correctly was automatically entered in our grand prize draw for one of five Bose SoundDock digital music systems. Answer every week for the 9 weeks of our quiz, and you'll have nine times the chances of winning. We've already given away one SoundDock, and now it's time to announce our second lucky winner. And that winner is Adam Weiss from Boston, Massachusetts. Thanks, Adam, for participating in our quiz. And to all of those who didn't win, your correct answers are still valid and eligible for our next draw. So don't stop now. Here's this week's quiz. And our question this week has to do with water quality. The question is, what waterborne parasite killed 54 people and made hundreds of thousands more sick when water treatment facilities failed in Milwaukee in 1993? Remember, we're looking for a one-word answer. To enter, visit www.newscientist.com/podcast. Please send in your answer before 5 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday, December 6th. We'll announce our next winner during the December 16th episode of SciPod.
Planet. Life. Body. Mind. NewScientist.com. From the infinitely large to the fleetingly fast, NewScientist.com. It's your online resource to science, nature, and technology. With daily stories about cloning, climate change, stem cells, nanotechnology, evolution. Your world runs on science. Don't let that world pass you by. Visit NewScientist.com today.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the December 3rd edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, baby fat. Why expectant mothers who follow U.S. government guidelines for weight gain during pregnancy may be priming their children for obesity. The gathering storm. A bitter argument is raging in the scientific community over whether global warming is making hurricanes more destructive. And Digital Buddy. Researchers are making progress on software that can recognize your emotional states. We'll have this and lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.